Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin. In the first half of the 18th century, the British colonies in North America experienced a remarkable religious revival. So powerful was this revival that it was given the name the Great Awakening, implying that religiosity in America at the time was lethargic and uninspired. Charismatic figures such as George Whitefield, William Tennant, James Davenport, Samuel Davies, and Jonathan Edwards loom large in the history of this era. Scenes of circuit riders on horseback moving from town to town, open-air sermonizing to crowds of thousands, and individuals brought to Jesus through emotional conversion also dominate the images of the Great Awakening. What gave rise to this spiritual explosion, and what impact did it have on the trajectory of religion and politics in America? Joining me today to discuss these questions is Thomas Kidd, Associate Professor of History, a Senior Fellow at the Institute for Studies of Religion, and Co-Director of the Program on Historical Studies of Religion, all at Baylor University. He is also author of several books on religion in America during the 18th century, including The Protestant Interest, New England After Puritanism, and The Great Awakening, The Roots of Evangelical Christianity in Colonial America, both from Yale University Press. We should also note that Professor Kidd will be releasing his next book, God of Liberty, A Religious History of the American Revolution, in just a few weeks. So we'll put links on that on our website so you can find these books. Our attention today, though, is going to be on his research on the Great Awakening. Tommy, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thanks, Tony.
A few questions to get us started here, and one might be a little bit off topic, but I know that you let me call you Tommy rather than Thomas, and in academia, that's really kind of rare for us professorial intellectual types to prefer to exude a distinguished air. So why Tommy and not Thomas?
Well, I guess part of the answer is I have tenure now at Baylor, so I can do whatever I want.
Oh, there you go.
But I grew up in South Carolina, and lots of men there go by, I guess, what you would call the diminutive, and there are lots of Tommies, and mm-hmm. I just never dropped the name. So, yeah, my professional, on the books is Thomas, but friends call me Tommy, so you can call me Tommy.
Oh, okay, all right. Well, you can call me Most Honorable Sir Anthony Gill. Yeah, I'm just joking. Tony is fine. I prefer the short names, and I grew up in the Midwest, and so that had the same kind of colloquial names, and in academia you don't find that too much.
Right.
Anyways, let's talk about the Great Awakening. Now, you're a historian, and we all know that historians love dates. Not the tree fruit or taking your spouse to the movie, but the calendar kind of dates. So if we were to put the first Great Awakening into a time frame, or perhaps a narrow time frame that is recognized by most historians, what era are we talking about here?
Well, I think most historians would date it at something like 1740 to 43.
Mm-hmm. Did it start like January 12th at 5 p.m. or something?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, usually they're thinking in terms of the arrival of George Whitefield, the greatest evangelist of the Great Awakening,
mm-hmm.
and then 1743 is when things start to sort of cool down, at least in New England, which is probably the most important region for the Great Awakening. So that it's arbitrary, but that's usually about the dates that people are thinking.
But in your book, you make a very convincing case that is just the narrow time dates, that the Great Awakening really can be traced backwards in time more and forwards in time. So could you mm-hmm. speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, well, one of the things that's a problem with the idea of the Great Awakening, capital T, capital G, capital A, Great Awakening, is that it makes it seem a little bit more official and formal and easily dated than it actually is. I mean, there are things going on that look like what we would call revivals, Mm-hmm. In America, they're going back to, you know, the 1670s, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
If you trace it back to Europe, England, Scotland, and so forth, I mean, the roots are even deeper there. And then there are revivals going on after 1743. I mean, if you take a New England-centered approach to the Great Awakening, you know, 1740 to 43 maybe makes sense. But, you know, if you look at the South, really the heights of what I consider to be the Great Awakening happens later. But there's, you know, there's significant revivals going on in New England in the 1760s and mm-hmm. the 1780s. And then it slides into, in the early 1800s, what people call the Second Great Awakening.
Right.
Now, I do think that, I mean, and of course my book is called The Great Awakening, so I do accept that that term, but it does cause some problems in terms of understanding the history of revivalism in the 18th century.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would imagine that if you take the narrow date and you start your research there, you're going to miss a lot of the, you know, causal undercurrents that are feeding into this, and
that's right. And
mostly think that's just a George Whitefield thing. But you know, your book makes an excellent case that there was a lot of other things going on there. Now, before we talk about some of these reasons for why the Great Awakening exploded in the early 1700s, dating back into late 1600s, I have one other question that I think will help us set the table here, and that is in regards to the general state of religiosity in colonial America at the time. You know, when I think back to my high school history classes, the British American colonies are always portrayed with pictures of families in Puritan garb walking off to church on Sundays. It was a time of high religiosity in some respects. That's the way it was presented to me. And in fact, you know, you would look back and ask most people, and they say, yeah, the 17th and 18th centuries were probably the high water mark for religion or religiosity in our nation. Now, if that is true, that people were saturated with spirituality, why would there even be a need for a Great Awakening? I mean, were people falling asleep at this time or what?
Right. Well, that's a contested issue. I mean, you know, exactly how religious people were, and there's been a lot of work that has suggested that maybe people were not quite as spiritually serious back in those days as maybe the popular stereotype would have it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that on one hand, you know, if you did a poll of people in 1740, you know, the vast, vast majority of colonists would have said that they were Christians.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, there were a few Jews, but I mean, there's almost no other option. They live in a world that is heavily shaped by religion. If they own a book, it is the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people know the Bible. They read the Bible. So it's a very religious world. But you know, there are also signs that you know, the church membership rates, for instance, in many places were quite low.
Mm-hmm.
Now, part of the reason for that, especially in the South, is because there are almost no churches, period.
Right.
Because, you know, you just have to have an infrastructure for that. You have to have people who are willing to get together and support a church and pay a minister and this kind of thing. And there just was not that sort of infrastructure in a lot of cases for churches, especially as you got out onto the frontier.
Mm-hmm.
I think in New England, people were, especially at the founding of New England, Massachusetts was founded in 1630, you know, they are very, very religious, and it's mm-hmm. a religious mission that brings about the founding of the colony. Same with Connecticut. But I also think that, you know, when you get 100 years later after the founding of those colonies, maybe some religious apathy has set in.
Mm-hmm.
They're not quite up to the standards of the original founders. You know, maybe they've gotten distracted by business and you know, other pursuits. And you know, there's historians that will talk about these horseshed Christians. You know, that'll you know, they'll go to church, but they you know, they'll kind of sneak out maybe when the sermon starts and go talk business out at the horseshed.
Yeah.
You know,
mm-hmm.
I mean, so it differs from person to person. But I think that the Awakening does a couple different things, and one is that it renews the religious commitment of people like in New England who, you know, knew that their forebears were very, very serious about their faith.
Well, what's
maybe
that?
They had fallen away from that a bit. And then in places like the South, I think it is not a kind of awakening, but a new religious zeal in places where maybe it hadn't existed at all. So I think it's kind of a mixed bag. They're probably not as you know religious across the board as the popular stereotype would have it, but they're also not just a bunch of pagans running around.
Right.
I mean, they live in a heavily Christian world.
Well, I know in respect to New England, I believe it was in the later 1600s, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, that they were talking about something known as the Halfway Covenant, which they were finding that a lot of their population couldn't meet the high, rigorous standards of puritanical, you know, Congregationalist religion, and so they relaxed the requirements a little bit. To me, it would seem to signify that, you know, after a couple of generations, one or two generations, that religiosity is tending to wane in some of the young'uns.
Yeah. Well, and it's partly a product that the Puritans, as a stereotype would have it, and this is reality, they had very high standards about faith. And one of the reasons why you find that membership is surprisingly low, church membership is surprisingly low in the Puritan colonies, is that in order to join a Puritan church, you had to have a clear conversion testimony. You had to, you know, have a testimony of this dramatic work of God in your life for salvation, and you had to stand up in front of the members of the church and deliver this testimony in a convincing enough way that they would vote to allow you to join their church. And that what this did is it allowed you, the membership allowed you to take the Lord's Supper or communion. And the Puritans, like many traditional Christians, believe that if you took communion in an unworthy manner, as the scripture talks about, that you were, in effect, eating and drinking damnation unto yourself. Right? I mean, this is a fearsome thing, right? I mean, they were, in many cases, scared to take on the responsibility of membership.
Right.
So with the Halfway Covenant, I mean, that's, you know, I won't go into all the details because it's a pretty complicated church, you know, polity kind of business, but basically, the question comes, if the parents are not members of the church, if they've never had that powerful conversion experience and they can't, you know, get a membership in the church that way, do they still have the right to baptize their children? And the Halfway Covenant said, yes, we'll concede that if you have people who are trying to live sort of moral lives and they come to church and that sort of thing, but they just haven't had the conversion, we'll still let those people baptize their children. So on one hand, that means that there's less conversions happening than maybe they would like to see. On the other hand, it means that those parents still want to have their children baptized.
Right.
And so there still is a kind of basic level of religiosity that, that and commitment that they have. They want to be part of the church. They want their children to be part of the church.
What about the demographics of the nation at this time as well? I mean, I think it was Rod Stark in his book with Roger Finke pointed out to me that, you know, the 1600s in the Americas were, that was a frontier society, and that the people who get drawn to frontier societies typically are younger males. And if you look around on any given Sunday at church, the, you know, you're not going to find a whole lot of 20-something-year-old single males there. Is that going on here, too, in the colonies?
Yes. Again, there's a stark difference between what's happening in New England to the middle colonies to the south. Probably New England has the most nuclear families that are migrating together. Down to the south, the early decades of migration are almost exclusively single young men. And I think, you know, it you have to be hesitant about saying, you know, young men in those days were like young men today. Nevertheless, I think, you know, religion throughout American history tends to be more female than male in
right.
terms of who's in the pews.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think it's probably also the case that young men, maybe tend to have other interests in their, maybe going out and trying to find, opportunity, hunting land, this kind of thing, in areas where there's just not churches.
Mm-hmm.
Where, in the Puritan towns, you have families, gathered around, the town church and that sort of thing. So I think that demographically there are some patterns there. And the Great Awakening, in part, and if this is true, then one of the reasons that the Great Awakening takes off in the South when it does is because finally you're starting to see a kind of stabilization of demographics into more of a family model.
Right.
And then evangelical religion is ready to take off in the South at that time in a way that it hadn't before.
What about also in the Southern colonies? You had mentioned that there were very few churches at the time. Now, I know that the Southern colonies tended to be dominated by the Anglican Church, the Church of England.
Right.
And we know the story of the Puritans. They're escaping religious persecution. They're trying to reform the Church of England in England, and then they basically say, well, we'll just go to Massachusetts and everything will be fine. We'll create our own city on a hill, so to speak. But in the Southern colonies, that was really Anglican territory. And I can only imagine that if you were an Anglican clergy member, would you rather be stationed in London, the center of where everything has happened, or would you rather go to the, backwoods Carolinas? And you're like, whoa. So, I mean, is that going on? Is it there, the clergy of the Anglican church down there less fervent, or just it's not a career path most people would follow?
Yeah. I think that that's generally true. I mean, I think there have been people who have tried to argue in recent years that the Anglican Church was stronger in the South than we've given credit for.
Mm-hmm.
But I still think that your general point is true, that the Anglican Church is structurally weak in the South in a way that the Puritan or Congregationalist churches.
Mm-hmm.
As compared to the Puritan and Congregationalist churches in North and New England in particular. Part of the issue is there's no Anglican bishop in the colonies.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that you can't have the ordination of priests
mm-hmm.
in the colonies. And this is a really serious issue because the trip across the Atlantic Ocean is, at any time is likely to result in a shipwreck and death of everyone on board.
Right.
And so to say to someone, a devout Anglican young man in the colonies, in order to become a priest, you have to travel to England, get ordained, and come back.
Mm-hmm.
There's not many people who want to take that on. And, financing it is difficult. And like you said, I mean, I think people in England often viewed the colonies as a backwater.
Mm-hmm.
That they were, just a bunch of hicks over, on the other side of the Atlantic, and that, you really would only want to go there in a lot of cases for, business opportunities or for a kind of religious seclusion.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're wanting to be, cosmopolitan and near the centers of power, you don't want to go to the colonies. And
okay.
So the Anglican Church in the South has a, relatively strong structural presence in the Atlantic coast cities,
mm-hmm.
Williamsburg and Charleston and this sort of thing. But once you get into the backcountry at all, they're almost entirely absent for a lot of the colonial period. And there are complaints about, people need just basic things done. They need to have their children baptized, and yet they go for years without access to a priest. They need to have weddings done.
Yeah,
the priests aren't there.
Mm-hmm.
There's just a lot of weakness, and I do think that there are probably a high percentage of the priests who end up in the colonies who, for a variety of reasons, are sort of unmotivated, or mm-hmm. Classically, they're drunks and this sort of thing. Now, I mean, there are some Anglicans in the colonies that are very, very serious and very serious Christians and devout in their way and try to do their best. But I think the Puritan colonies, and you could say the same for the Presbyterian churches of the Middle Colonies, the Quakers, and so forth. I mean, their denominations are just a lot more nimble and responsive to what's going on, you know, on the ground, as compared to the Anglicans, who are sort of lumbering and ineffective.
Let me, since you bring up the different regions, and one of the things I like about your book is that you explain very clearly that there wasn't just one The Great Awakening, even in the time frame that we're talking about, but that the country really was regionally different. You had the New England colonies, which was the home of Puritan Congregationalism. You had the middle colonies at New York, Pennsylvania, Delaware, New Jersey, that included a mix of religious groups such as Quakers, Presbyterians, Dutch Reform, and the like. And then you had the southern colonies, where we were talking about how the Anglican church tended to hold sway. Was the Great Awakening more vigorous in some of these areas? Is that even an appropriate question to ask? And were there different flavors to it in these different regions?
Yeah. Well, I think that the epicenter, if you will, of the Great Awakening is New England.
Mm-hmm.
Again, there's the structure there. There's an eagerness for it. There's precedents of religious strength. I mean, in a way, the awakening rides as much on previous religious strength as it does weakness. And a lot of the Puritan churches, or sort of formerly Puritan churches, are just ready for this kind of renewal of their religious mission.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of pastors there who are very sympathetic to what the revivalists are trying to do, who invite people like Whitfield into their pulpits. And so that stretch from 1740 to 43 in New England is the real power center of the Great Awakening. In the Middle Colonies, the effects of the Awakening are more diffuse because the Middle Colonies, as you said, are diverse religiously. The Middle Colonies are sort of the original melting pot, because you have all these different ethnic groups, and ethnicity is almost always connected with a particular denominational religion.
Right, you have the
like
Scottish,
you said, the Dutch Reformed,
right, Dutch
Scots,
Reformed.
Irish Presbyterian, you know, and so on and so forth. In the Middle Colonies, I think, you know, many of those ethnic groups participate in the Awakening in their way. There's a tradition of Christian pietism on the continent of Europe, especially in Germany, places like this, that in the 17th century, Protestant pastors had begun to talk about the religion of the heart as opposed to a formal kind of church-centered religion. The people had started talking in the 17th century about having small group meetings for prayer and exhortation and fellowship and this sort of, which was just brand new to be thinking about these kind of, you know, extra churchly kind of religion.
Yeah, I want to point that out, just a little tangent here. That was one of the interesting things I found in your book, the use of small groups. I mean, I'm familiar with that term, you know, at our church, and you know, you think about other mega churches and stuff where they have small groups to make the large church seem much smaller. And you think of that as a being a relatively new innovation, but, you know, this dates back 300 years.
Yeah, at least to the 17th century. That's right. And it's coming out of this pietist movement from the continent in Europe. And lots of people in America, you know, have learned from these pastors, or their writings are circulating among German groups and Presbyterians and so forth. And so there's a lot of ferment there. I think the strongest revivalist movement in the Middle Colonies, though, is coming from the Scots-Irish Presbyterians. There's thousands and thousands of immigrants from Ulster or Northern Ireland that are coming into the Middle Colonies in the 17-teens and 20s. This is represented best by the Tennant family.
Right.
William Tennant is the father, and then there's several revivalist sons, the most important of which is Gilbert Tennant. They're responsible for founding an academy in Pennsylvania that becomes a kind of forerunner to the College of New Jersey at Princeton, which was originally basically an evangelical seminary for training Presbyterian revivalists.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a long tradition going back into Scotland and Northern Ireland of these revivals that go back to, you know, way back into maybe the 1620s and so forth, where they would have these massive celebrations of the Lord's Supper that would happen maybe, you know, quarterly, huge social events that would last all weekend. People would come from the surrounding region, and they would have open-air communion festivals where the pastors would give tokens to people who they believed were really converted and therefore suited to take the Lord's Supper. Mm-hmm. And they would have long tables out in the fields where they would have these celebrations of the Lord's Supper, and they were very emotional, moving, intense preaching, and then capped off with this open-air celebration of the Lord's Supper. They were called holy fairs. The mockers would call them the holy fairs.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was a deep tradition that you see going on in the Great Awakening in Pennsylvania and New Jersey and so forth.
Before we move on to the Southern colonies, one thing I want to ask a little bit is, you know, since you mentioned these open field meetings and open field sermonizing and such, what was the characteristics of the Great Awakening? I mean, what kind of things happened? You mentioned Gilbert Tennant in your book. He's quite a character.
He's a character.
So tell us a little bit about him and what, you know, what was different about the Great Awakening that differentiated it maybe from earlier, you know, religiosity in America.
Well, one of the things that's different is the way that the revival meetings would be held. I think tended to be much more emotional, in a way more informal than meetings that would happen before. And this is in both Anglican churches and Congregationalist churches, Presbyterian churches, you would have, before the Great Awakening, you would tend to have church services that were very formal, and they focused on the preaching of sermons, and this is especially the case in New England. Often Sunday sermons would last 2 hours. Heavily doctrinal, often read from a manuscript, verbatim.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the best pastors would try to give it with some feeling, but nevertheless, I mean, they were very intellectual.
Yeah, if you ever had
and
a
people
professor.
Accepted this. I mean, it's not like they had all kinds of other things distracting them, you know,
right.
Media culture and so forth. I mean, this, you know, this is their social outlet from, you know, other than being on the farm, you know.
That's true, but I have to say that, you know, I think most students can appreciate this. If you ever have a professor read from their notes, even if they have, you know, good cadence to their voice and stuff, man, it's boring.
Yeah, it's boring almost anything. Of course, you know, we have things that are constantly demanding our attention that they didn't. So they had lower standards than we do. But
do students at Baylor?
Maybe they had higher standards. But anyway,
do students at Baylor use Facebook while in lecture?
No,
that would never happen here at the Washington.
It would never be tolerated.
No.
Anyway, and so if you take Whitfield as an example or Gilbert Tennant, I think that the sermons tended to be given in an extemporaneous way. A lot of pastors would talk about the moment at which they become convicted that they need to stop using manuscripts.
Mm-hmm.
And that they can preach without notes from the heart, and as God led them to preach,
mm-hmm.
Under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit. And the messages, especially by the itinerants, the traveling preachers, Whitfield being the most important of them, they could give the same message over and over and over to different crowds and different places, and they had a razor focus on the message that people needed to be born again.
Mm-hmm.
This is following Jesus' teaching in John chapter 3, that you, in order to see the kingdom of heaven, you have to be born again.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so where in previous you know, church settings, and this continued on through the Great Awakening and beyond, you would have, you know, that kind of broad doctrinal coverage preaching through various books of the Bible, but the itinerants are saying, you know, it's not good enough to be religious. It's not good enough to know about the Bible. It's not good enough to attend church. What I want to know is, are you born again?
Mm-hmm.
Have you experienced the converting work of God in your life? And they keep the focus on that experience alone. And it tends to get very impassioned, emotional. Whitfield has a background as a stage actor before his conversion, and he brings some of that talent into his preaching. Even though he repudiates stage acting, he brings the techniques of the theater into his preaching, and so he's very emotional in his preaching. He takes on characters from the Bible and almost acts out his sermons rather than just reading some doctrine about something. He's pleading with people to accept Christ's offer of salvation. And in the case of Tennant, you know, you mentioned about Tennant being a character. I mean, Tennant and even more than Whitfield is so controversial. He's angry about what religion has become in the standard churches of the colonies. He thinks it's become rote and cold and lifeless. He not only preaches that people need to experience what they call the new birth, but he even says that some of the pastors of the colonial churches themselves have not experienced the new birth. And so his most famous sermon, Tennant's most famous sermon, is called The Danger of an Unconverted Ministry. And this is just radical, right? I mean, yeah. Nobody before would dare to challenge the pastors in this way. I mean, they're among the most respected members of the community. In most of the colonies, they have the backing of the state. The government is paying their salary. They have the blessing of the state. And so to stand up publicly and to say, I don't think, Pastor Bob has even experienced the new birth, and if your church is lifeless and cold, maybe you need to put the blame on the pastor.
I can only imagine.
And if that's the case, then you need to go to a different church, which was, in many cases, illegal. Right.
Or you'd have to pay twice because you're already paying for the Congregationalist tax, and your church is going to ask for donations as well. I can only imagine that there's going to be a lot of pushback on this. A intellectualized ordained minister, or some guy comes in, and Gilbert Tennant had visions, didn't he? He was kind of a guy that went out into the woods and had visions, right?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the Tennant brothers had these very dramatic, sort of catatonic experiences, and a lot of the pastors would have these sorts of experiences that kind of mark the beginning of their pastoral career. I mean, they felt that they had a visitation from God, directly, and they would, often go into a trance. Maybe it was associated with a sickness that they had. They were near death, and they would come out of these trances or comas, and they would say, God has appeared to me. I've gone to heaven and seen, scenes like from the Book of Revelation and this kind of thing. And now I know that God has put a special calling on my life. And so if you've had that sort of experience and you believe it in your heart that you have, that breeds a certain courage and radicalism that you're willing to say anything because you think that, as the Blues Brothers said, I'm on a mission from God.
Right.
I mean, you can do anything because God has called you to do this. And so they would just say anything. They would confront anybody. They would risk fines and imprisonment. They would risk physical harm from beatings and so forth. They were so provocative, so confrontational, that to a lot of their opponents, it just seemed like an insurrection. And it got so bad sometimes, like with the person I think is the greatest character of all these radicals is James Davenport in New England. And at one point, it gets so out of hand with him in Hartford, Connecticut, that they have to call out the state militia after him and his followers to subdue what they think is just an outright revolution.
And it's interesting, as you know, that many of these pastors actually went out of their way, not necessarily to compete with the more established churches, but they had their open-air meetings Sunday afternoon after churches had let out. Is that correct?
Yes.
And one thing, I just got to ask this, because it's when I read these stories of Whitfield and others talking in these you know, open fields, and, you know, they talk about several thousand people showing to this. Do you know anybody who's ever tested that? Because I was just at a Cub Scout camp, and we had, I don't know, about 300 Cub Scouts in a field, and the guy was trying to talk, and I couldn't hear anything with all these kids screaming. I mean, is it possible for Whitfield or Davenport or Tennant, any of these guys, to give a sermon to thousands of people in an open field? I mean, how did that happen?
Yeah, and of course, this is before any kind of electricity or amplification,
right,
or anything like that. And this is a really interesting issue because it leads into the connection between Whitfield and Ben Franklin,
mm-hmm,
who were good friends.
Mm-hmm.
Franklin was Whitfield's publisher and publicist. I mean, he was Whitfield's sort of greatest fan in Philadelphia.
Well, he loved the sermons because they sold well.
Yes, I mean, Franklin made a tremendous amount of money off of selling Whitfield's stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, he sold sermons. He even sold pictures of Whitfield. You know, these kind of mezzotint, drawings or imprints of Whitfield. And so, Franklin loved having Whitfield around, even though Franklin was no traditional Christian.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I bring this up is that Whitfield was routinely criticized for faking numbers of people who he said had appeared at his revival meetings.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, he would have these meetings, and there would be more people at the meeting than lived in the town he was preaching in, right? I mean, just these gargantuan crowds.
Sounds like voting in Chicago.
Yeah, right. I mean, the number of people he's claiming are probably the biggest crowds that had ever assembled in the history of North America,
uh-huh,
ever, right? I mean, that's how big he's saying they are.
Right.
You know, 20,000, 25,000 people. And in England, they were supposed to be even larger.
Wow.
And so Franklin, who was, you know, he really liked Whitfield and liked, you know, promoting him and so forth. He actually looked into this in Philadelphia, Franklin was kind of hanging around one of Whitfield's revival meetings, and Franklin talks about this in his autobiography. He has great sections in his autobiography about his friendship with Whitfield. I mean, as usual with Franklin, it's hilarious stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Franklin measured out the dimensions of where all the people were standing, and you know, did a calculation. You know, gave, you know, one person for, you know, this many square feet and all this sort of stuff. And Franklin said that he thought that realistically 25,000 people could hear Whitfield speaking at one time.
Wow.
Now, you know, take that for what it is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is not exactly the most, you know, scientifically rigorous thing. But I think, you know, they're not used to amplification.
Right.
They may have been used to settings in which, you know, what does it mean that you can hear Whitfield? Does it mean that you can hear him at all?
Mm-hmm.
You know, very faintly? You know, are people being very quiet during Whitfield's talks? Are people jammed together shoulder to shoulder? I think, and Whitfield, by all accounts, has to be one of the greatest orators of all time. I think a lot of people could hear him.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you also have to take into account that he was such a superstar. He was really the first sort of modern media superstar. You know, intense newspaper coverage before he would show up promoting his meetings.
Mm-hmm.
That people were so excited about his meetings that you can imagine people coming and they would try to get where they could hear him, but they couldn't, but they would stay anyway.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just because of the excitement of the occasion. You know, sort of like people hanging around outside the stadium even though you couldn't get a ticket to,
right,
see U2 or something like that.
Just to
like
be
that,
there,
you know?
Right.
It's that sort of feel. It's a phenomenon, and people want to be part of it even if maybe they can't actually hear his voice.
Well, let me talk about Whitfield a little bit more, and this I guess, transitions us a little bit to the Great Awakening in the Southern colonies, which, you know, Whitfield played a very important role, much like a Johnny Appleseed, as you mentioned. There's publication, pre-publication that he comes down here. He goes to Charleston, and you tell some great stories of him in Charleston. I mean, he was arrested for a period of time because he's so controversial, yet he has his defenders and still is able to plant the seeds for this revival in probably the most lackadaisical religious area in the colonies at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So give us some stories about what's Whitfield about down here in the southern colonies. What, I mean, he's a guy who can't stay still.
Yeah, he's a rambler. I mean, and he often will sort of start trouble in one place and then get bored and kind of take off. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I think that's one of the least appealing things about Whitfield, is that he often left local pastors sort of holding the bag.
Right.
But, you know, in a place like Charleston, where he gets in trouble in Charleston, is that Whitfield is, for his whole life, he's an Anglican, mm-hmm. You know, Church of England priest. But in the colonies, the Church of England priests and what they called commissaries, who's, you know, were kind of a stand-in because you didn't have a bishop, so that, you know, these leading officials for the Anglicans in the towns were usually his greatest opponents.
Mm-hmm.
And there was the commissary in Charleston, a guy named Alexander Garden, you know, was trying to tell Whitfield, look, you know, you're an Anglican priest, you need to do what I say. You can't just run around and kind of, you know, make these accusations about Anglican priests not being converted and, you know, just preach wherever you want to. You shouldn't be, making friends with the dissenters, you know, which is what the Anglicans would call the Congregationalists and Presbyterians, mm-hmm. who Whitfield often liked better than he liked the Anglicans. And, you know, Whitfield got summoned to Garden's house at one point, and Garden...
Who was Garden?
He was the Anglican commissary in Charleston.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so Whitfield gets called on the carpet, and he just basically starts insulting Garden. I mean, he just says, I'm not going to listen to anything you say. I treat that like I treat, something the Pope said for me to do. You know, they're all heavily anti-Catholic, and so that's a really bad insult. And so, you know, Garden threw him out of his house, and I mean, it really got ugly, you know. And you know, Whitfield is, yeah, I mean, he's getting periodically detained and arrested for these controversial, seditious comments that he's making. And over time, as I said, he's gravitating more and more towards these dissenters, the sort of outliers, you know, who are the Congregationalists outside the establishment in the Anglican colonies. And that ends up being where the strength of the revivalist movement comes from in almost all the colonies. But especially you can see it in the South, that it's a kind of dissenting movement. Mm-hmm. Against the established church, where in New England the Congregationalists are often in favor of the revivals, and they're the established church in New England. The Anglicans in the South are often very opposed to it. And so Whitfield, even though he stays as an Anglican for his whole career, he's cooperating with all kinds of different denominations.
Yeah.
And that's a unique aspect, I think, of the Great Awakening too, is that it's probably one of the first times that you see a kind of evangelical interdenominational movement, because to people like Whitfield, the question is not whether you're Anglican, Congregationalist, Presbyterian, or Baptist. It's, have you been born again?
Right.
And that crosses denominational line.
And that's something that's always interested me about Whitfield. In many ways, a couple of years ago, reading up on him, it was somewhat surprising to find out he was an Anglican all his life, because I know, you know, being associated with a Methodist church right now, the Methodists tend to lay claim to him, mm-hmm. that he tends, you know, you get this feel for him as just being, and he had contact with Wesley, is that correct?
Absolutely, yeah. In fact, Whitfield's conversion happens partly through the ministry of John and Charles Wesley. Going back to the 1730s, they were all together at Oxford University,
mm-hmm.
and they were part of what's called the Holy Club. But their mockers called them, you know, the Holy Club. The, you know, these these groups of sort of spiritually serious Christians at Oxford, and these Methodists, you know, and at that time, you know, the Methodist is just a name for this kind of reform group at Oxford, and then it spreads out to the Anglican denomination in general, that they are really focused on the spiritual disciplines, the method of spirituality that's being taught by Wesley and so forth, and so it's in that context that that Whitfield experiences conversion.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is, and it doesn't take too long before Whitfield and John Wesley have a parting of ways over theology.
Mm-hmm.
Whitfield is, you know, an evangelical in the sense that he believes in the experience of being born again, that's the most important thing about faith. But he's also a Calvinist.
Mm-hmm.
And so he believes in, you know, predestination and you know, the election of believers. You know, it's really God's choice about who's saved. Where Wesley is an Arminian, and he believes that we have free will to choose to be saved. And so they split over that issue. So Whitfield does have that kind of deep background in the early Methodist movement, but it's not too long before Whitfield and Wesley, you know, they're not working together anymore. Mm-hmm. And you know, Wesley and John and Charles Wesley go on to establish this kind of formal Methodist movement within the Anglican Church that eventually breaks off from the Anglican Church.
Mm-hmm.
And Whitfield really doesn't start a denomination. And I think that's one of the reasons why he's not better known today.
Mm-hmm.
Is because he doesn't have the Methodists, you know, maybe claim him. Some evangelical Anglicans, I'm sure, claim him. But he doesn't have he's not the founder of a denomination.
Yeah, the stories, and I encourage everybody to pick up a copy of your book, The Great Awakening. The stories of Whitfield are great because you have to pull out a map, and he's bouncing all over the place, you know, planting churches or, you know, giving sermons and roiling the waters and then moving on somewhere else. It's just it's a wonderful story that you tell in there. Let me go ahead and move onto the impacts of the Great Awakening. So we've talked a little bit about, you know, where it comes from in the different parts of the colonies at this point in time. But what impact does this have going into the second half of the 18th century? I mean, we could think about perhaps abolitionism. You mentioned that a little bit in your book, the anti-slavery movement. What impact does the Great Awakening, if any, have on that?
Well, I think that it has a really powerful impact on the view of slavery. I mean, when one of the reasons the Great Awakening is so powerful and successful is because I think it is fundamentally egalitarian, mm-hmm. focused on the equality of all people before God. And they're equal in the sense that they all need to be born again. Before the Great Awakening, of course, slavery is most prevalent in the South,
mm-hmm.
and Southern Anglicans were typically fairly reticent about preaching the gospel to the slaves,
mm-hmm.
because there was a common belief that if you made slaves Christians, that it would give them ideas about their dignity and worth before God, and that they didn't deserve to be slaves anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And there was some question legally, even in English legal culture, about if a slave becomes a Christian, does that automatically mean that they'll be emancipated?
Mm-hmm.
And so that there was some lack of clarity about that made Anglicans pretty reluctant to preach the gospel to the slaves. Evangelicals had no such hesitation. And so they would preach the gospel to anyone who would listen, and that included slaves, you know, poor people, Native Americans, you know, whoever, all comers, they would tell about the gospel. And this means that there are lots and lots of African Americans who are becoming Christians, and there are growing numbers of African Americans and slaves who are joining evangelical churches. They have, you know, powerful spiritual testimonies, and some of them exhort in evangelical meetings. So you have the almost totally unprecedented scenes of slaves standing up in evangelical meetings and telling white people about their experience with God, mm-hmm. and white people taking them seriously.
Mm-hmm.
You don't see this happening anywhere else in colonial America.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you have this kind of thing going on in your church, how can you keep that person as a slave?
Mm-hmm.
The pressure against the logic of slavery just becomes kind of unbearable. Now, in that first generation of the evangelical preachers, people like Whitfield, Jonathan Edwards, James Davenport, many of them are slave owners themselves. Usually not, you know, major slave owners, but so like Jonathan Edwards, for instance, usually has one or two household slaves.
Mm-hmm.
And they may be critical about the way that slaves are often treated. They may be critical about the slave trade, but they don't quite get around to being against slavery itself. But in the second generation of evangelicalism in America, you have a massive outbreak of anti-slavery sentiment. So Jonathan Edwards is not anti-slavery, but his son, Jonathan Edwards Jr., is.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you look at the early anti-slavery movement in America, and there are both whites and African-Americans who are prominent anti-slavery writers, the majority of them in those early years, in the late 18th century, are evangelical Christians.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that there's a direct connection between that message of the fundamental dignity and equality of all people before God and the emergence of the anti-slavery movement. And then that continues on down through the abolitionist movement preceding the Civil War, that many, many of the leading abolitionists, not all, but many of them are evangelical Christians.
Mm-hmm. So the First Awakening plants the seeds for the Second Great
yeah.
Awakening in the abolition movement. You also mentioned that John Newton, the man who wrote Amazing Grace and a former slave shipper, was touched by the Great Awakening as well, right?
That's right, in England, yeah. And he actually, in some of his slave trading journeys across the Atlantic, he ended up meeting especially one of the leading evangelical pastors in Charleston. But most of his conversion, his path towards conversion is centered in England, and then he becomes one of the early anti-slavery agitators and influences William Wilberforce. You have this movie that came out lately, Amazing Grace, about them. Almost all these people are evangelicals influenced by the Great Awakening, which we have to remember is not just an American phenomenon. It's also happening in England, Scotland, Wales, and the continent of Europe.
Now, you make that very clear in your book that, you know, again, as we mentioned earlier, the early origins of it, you know, in Scotland, in Germany, you know, coming over to the United States, and, you know, and then back and forth. I mean, Whitfield starts in England and has influence here in the United States, and then influence back in London and such. It certainly goes back and forth. Let me ask you about, and this gets into the topic of your next book, and we won't spend too much time on it because I think that'll be a separate podcast. But how does the Great Awakening affect the American Revolution? We're talking 1740s, so you're roughly three decades away from the big break with England.
Mm-hmm.
Was there any impact?
Well, yes and no. I think that on one hand, here you have what is the greatest social and cultural upheaval in America before the Revolution, the Great Awakening, happening in the 1740s, 30 years before independence. I think that there's a general sense among historians of how can this not have an influence on the Revolution, mm-hmm. somehow culturally preparing Americans for the Revolution. It's an uprising against traditional authority. I mean, as I said, you know, these pastors that are being denounced, they are agents of the state, right? I mean, they're being funded by the state. Nobody had dared to challenge their authority before. And so there's a kind of experience of rising up and against traditional authority, a massive challenge to traditional authority that had never really happened before on such a broad scale that happens beginning in the 1740s that I think, in at least an indirect way, has to have some kind of influence on the American Revolution. But I think you can overstate it, because for one thing, that most of the best known founding fathers, sort of the Washington, Jefferson, Franklin, Madison, and so forth, they're not evangelicals, and most of them are not directly influenced by the Great Awakening in their background. And so, they're obviously able to come over to the Revolution without that kind of evangelical influence.
Mm-hmm.
Conversely, there are a lot of evangelicals who don't support the Revolution. The majority of evangelicals in America do. But there are plenty of evangelicals who don't support the Revolution and stay as loyalists. So drawing a direct connection is a little bit difficult. Where I see the most practical outcome of the Great Awakening in terms of the politics in the American Revolution is the status of religion in the colonies and then going into the states and the national government.
Mm-hmm.
And that is that in the Great Awakening, you have a fundamental challenge to the state-established churches. In New England, it's the Congregationalist churches. In most of the rest of the colonies, it's the Anglican church. As I said, most of the colonies have an established state church, and you're not allowed to just start, other churches, usually without the state's permission.
Mm-hmm.
And if you, especially in New England, if you want to found what they called a separate church, it was illegal. You could not get permission to do it, and if you tried to do it, you could be fined and even thrown in jail.
Mm-hmm.
For doing it. So these are the people who start pushing against the state establishments of religion, and this grows and grows in power, so that by the 1770s, in the early 1770s in Virginia, you still have Baptist pastors being beaten up, harassed, fined, and in some cases thrown in jail for illegal preaching.
Mm-hmm.
And Jefferson and Madison, who are best known for their advocacy of religious freedom, their opinion of religious freedom is formed in part by watching the persecution of these evangelicals.
Right.
And they say, we don't agree with these people in terms of their religious beliefs, but this is deplorable. This is ridiculous that these people who are basically just conventional Christians are being harassed and imprisoned for their faith. We need to establish religious freedom and get out of the business of a state-supported denomination. And so from colony to colony across the board, there are these movements usually that culminate in the era of the Revolution for disestablishing the state churches.
Mm-hmm.
It's successful almost everywhere in America except for in New England. And New Englanders keep their state churches, in Massachusetts' case, right on through 1833. They have an official state church in Massachusetts. But the real culmination, I think, of this is in the First Amendment. You have the ban on an establishment of religion, a national establishment of religion. And the people who are supporting that are the real radicals coming out of the Great Awakening,
mm-hmm.
especially evangelical Baptists. And then these sort of deistic, maybe liberal Anglicans like Jefferson and Madison. And that to me, and this is, again, getting into the topic of my next book, that's such a fascinating synthesis,
mm-hmm.
is that the union of the deists and evangelicals to win religious freedom. But the point with the Great Awakening is that Jefferson and Madison could never have hoped to do what they did without the support of legions of evangelicals who wanted for religious freedom to be able to practice their own kind of revivalist Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a movement for secularism. It's a movement for religious freedom.
We do have one of our earlier podcasts by Mark David Hall makes some very similar points.
Yeah.
And in part here, this is a little shameless plug that I have to give, that there is a really good book out there that talks about the political dynamics of
yeah.
religious liberty.
I've heard something about
the pluralism.
That
yeah. It's called The Political Origins of Religious Liberty, and it is by me, and I will link to that on the website. I mean, in fact, it would be a great companion read with your book, The Great Awakening, and also your book coming out on the American Revolution that's coming up. And I think this is probably a pretty good place to stop, and we're going to have you back on the show and pick up the topic of religion and the 18th century, the American Revolution, at some point in the future here when your next book comes out. And so, Tommy, I want to thank you for being on Research on Religion. It's been great.
Great. Thank you, Tony.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.